You know the day destroys the night, night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide, break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side, yeah.
This is WBCR LP 97.7 on your FM dial, broadcasting from downtown Great Barrington in the Berkshire Hills of Western Massachusetts. That was The Doors. And this is Mickey Friedman. And this is The Other Side. There are, of course, many sides and many truths. This show is about some of the other sides of the story. My pick of the many stories out there. John Boniface is a co-founder of AfterDowningStreet.org and a Boston-based attorney specializing in constitutional law. On Friday, July 22, 2005, he spoke before almost 300 people in the First Congregational Church in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. The title of his talk was "The Downing Street Minutes and the Iraq War. Has the President Committed Impeachable Offenses?"
What I'd like to do tonight is talk first about how I got involved in this case against the war and the meaning of the case for our Constitution, which was brought on the eve of the invasion of Iraq, and then to talk about the Downing Street minutes and the implications now for the Downing Street of the Downing Street minutes for this president in terms of accountability. And then finally to discuss the question of the CIA leak investigation and its link to all of this. First, I want to just tell you how I got involved in this case. I was listening to On Point, a radio show that many of you may know that comes out of WBUR in Boston, in October 2002, which at the time was running a show as to whether or not Senator Robert Byrd's vision of the Constitution was outdated in this post-911 world. Senator Byrd had been articulating on the floor of the United States Senate his opposition to President Bush's resolution on Iraq on the grounds that it was unconstitutional and that only Congress had the power to send the nation to war and that this resolution did not amount to a proper declaration of war or anything of equivalent action. And so the subject was Senator Byrd simply out of his time? Because, in fact, now, post-911, we have to deal with these imminent security threats, and perhaps we should just shelve the War Powers Clause and do away with the idea that Congress, representing we the people, should be making the decision of going into war. Maybe we should invest this power in the president. And they had on the show a Stanford law professor who was supposedly an expert on these matters, and they had another number of people calling in. And finally, one person called in and said, well, why doesn't Congress just declare war? And the Stanford law professor responded, well, that's essentially what they've done. And I thought, well, that's exactly what Senator Byrd is saying, that they have not done that. And that's why, in fact, this matter ought to be brought to another branch of government, the judiciary, to determine whether, in fact, Congress did actually authorize this war with the October 2002 resolution. So then I set about to try to reach Senator Byrd. I figured, well, Senator Byrd and his eloquence in standing up against this resolution would make a great plaintiff, Byrd v. Bush, to challenge the president and whether or not he had the authority to go to war against Iraq based on that resolution. And I was trying to figure out how to get to him. Obviously, there are many walls to get to a United States senator. But I remembered that I had worked closely with Ken Heckler, Secretary of State of West Virginia, for many years. And I decided to call him up. This is soon after the resolution on Iraq had been passed. And I said, Ken, I really think that Senator Byrd should sue the president on whether or not he has the authority to go to war against Iraq. And Ken said, well, I think that's a good idea. Let me call the senator right now. and ask him about it. So he calls him, and he calls me back, and he said, the senator would like to speak with you Tuesday morning, and set up a phone call for him. And to the senator's credit, he had a lot of good questions about standing. Was he the right person to bring this kind of case? Would it be ripe? We're not yet at war at that time, so is it really ready to be brought into court? Who would the other plaintiffs be? I told him we would be reaching out to soldiers, and that the point here was to stand with soldiers and give them the backing that they need to bring this kind of case. He said, well, I'm going to think about this and get back to you by the end of the week. A couple days later, I received a phone call from the Senate Legal Counsel's office, and she called and she said, I understand you had a conversation with Senator Byrd about a case you want to bring. I said, that's true, but that was with Senator Byrd. I didn't have it with the United States Senate. She said, no, I assure you that this is solely a matter that will be between you, Senator Byrd, and me, and that I advise individual senators as well as the Senate as a whole on matters such as these. So I began to talk about it, and it became quite clear with her questions that she was very hostile to this notion of suing the president. And by the end of the call, I was pretty sure that she would go back to the senator and recommend he not get involved in anything like this. And suffice it to say, I didn't hear back. So I frankly backed off. I figured, well, if Senator Byrd, who stood up on the floor of the Senate, was not willing to stand up and sue, then who would? And I backed off. And then on New Year's Eve Day, 2002, the president held one of his impromptu press conferences at his ranch in Crawford, Texas, answering a couple questions. And one of the questions he got was this question from a reporter, Mr. President, it seems almost inevitable that we're headed to war against Iraq. And he shot back. He said, that's not for you to decide. That's for me to decide. And I sat there watching. I thought, that's not for either of you to decide. You know, the Constitution doesn't give reporters the power to take the nation to war any more than it gives presidents the power to take the nation to war. That's only for the United States Congress. And you ought to be sued and challenged over whether or not you have this authority. So then I got angry again and decided, let's try a different route here. And I work with my father, who we have a practice together, and we decide, let's locate the soldiers who will stand up, who are being put into harm's way, who are being sent over into this potentially illegal war. Let's have them first and foremost stand up, and then let's bring in parents of soldiers, and then we'll try to go the House of Representatives route. And so we found three U.S. soldiers, one of whom was a Marine based in the Persian Gulf at the time, ready to be sent into Iraq, one of whom was a member of the National Guard with imminent orders to be sent over, and one of whom was a member of the U.S. Army who had orders to be sent over as well. And then we reached out via a wonderful organization, Military Families Speak Out, to parents of soldiers around the country. And Military Families Speak Out brought them together to be part of this case, to be plaintiffs in this case. And then, of course, we came back to Congress, and this time we went to the House side, and we reached out to Congressman John Conyers, Jr., and Dennis Kucinich, and they led the way. And they got a dozen members of Congress together to be part of this lawsuit and be plaintiffs. And all of them served as this courageous coalition to sue the president in February of 2003. And I think that to really get a sense of what this case was about, we have to go back to that day on August 17, 1787, when the delegates to the Constitutional Convention debated this question: how would this new nation be taken into war? And Pierce Butler was a delegate from South Carolina. And he rose to suggest that the executive, the president, ought to have this power, arguing that he will, quote, have all the requisite qualities and will not make war, but when the nation will support it. Elbridge Gerry, a delegate from Massachusetts, rose to object. He said he never expected to hear in a republic a motion to empower the executive alone to declare war. Gerry's objection carried the day. The framers of the Constitution knew all too well the dangers of empowering one single individual with the awesome responsibility of taking a nation into war. They had experienced European monarchs of the past kings and queens of Europe, who would send their subjects off into battle, often on their own personal whim. And they were determined. They were determined that this new nation would not be operating that way, that in this new nation, in this democracy, we would only be taken into war through we the people, through our representatives in the United States Congress. The wars of kings and queens had brought not only havoc and destruction to the lives of those forced into battle and those left to suffer their loss, they had also brought poverty. Following King George's War in the 1740s, a citizen of Massachusetts distributed an anonymous pamphlet with this denunciation of those few who had made a fortune from the war. Quote, "Poverty and discontent appear in every face except the countenances of the rich, and dwell upon every tongue." The pamphleteer wrote of a few fed by lust of power, lust of fame, lust of money, who got rich during the war. No wonder, he wrote, such men can build ships, houses, buy farms, set up their coaches, chariots, live very splendidly, purchase fame, posts of honor. They were, he said, birds of prey, enemies to all communities, wherever they live. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11, emerged from that collective memory. The Congress shall have power to declare war. No other language is as simple and as clear in the United States Constitution. The framers and ratifiers of the Constitution shared Thomas Jefferson's desire to create, quote, an effectual check to the dog of war. George Mason said that he was for clogging rather than facilitating war. James Wilson, speaking at Pennsylvania's ratifying convention, stated, "This system will not hurry us into war. It is calculated to guard against it. It will not be in the power of a single man or a single body of men to involve us in such distress, for the important power of declaring war is vested in the legislature at large." Even Alexander Hamilton, the Constitutional Convention's staunchest supporter of executive power, would later write this: "The President is to be Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy of the United States. This would amount to nothing more than the supreme command and direction of the military and naval forces as First General and Admiral of the Confederacy, while that of the British King extends to the declaring of war and to the raising and regulating of fleets and armies, all which, by the Constitution under consideration, would appertain to the legislature." Several years after the adoption of the Constitution, James Madison would write these words: "In no part of the Constitution is more wisdom to be found than in the clause which confides the question of war or peace to the legislature and not to the executive department. Beside the objection to such a mixture of heterogeneous powers, the trust and the temptation would be too great for any one man." Now let us move to October 2002. And to understand what the President and the White House submitted to the Congress, let us imagine for the moment that the United States Congress were to pass a resolution which states the following: "The President is authorized to levy an income tax on the people of the United States in order to pay for subsidies to U.S. oil companies." Now, no amount of legal wrangling would make that resolution constitutional. The President does not have power to levy taxes on the American people. Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution guarantees that only Congress shall have that power. It's an exclusive power that Congress has for we the people to have taxes levied upon us through our representatives in Congress. Now let us turn to reality. In October 2002, the United States Congress passed a resolution which stated the following. The President is authorized to use the armed forces of the United States as he determines to be necessary and appropriate in order to, one, defend the national security of the United States against the continuing threat posed by Iraq, and two, enforce all relevant United Nations Security Council resolutions regarding Iraq, as he determines to be necessary and appropriate. Mr. President, you decide. You decide, based on whatever evidence or whatever lies you have, you decide whether or not to take this nation into war. We as a Congress will transfer this exclusive power over to you, and you will have that final decision-making responsibility. Congress cannot transfer this exclusive power, and the framers made that clear. And so as this hurried debate occurred in the Congress, weeks before a general election, when all members of the House of Representatives were up for re-election, one-third of the U.S. Senate up for re-election, the White House sends this resolution over to the Congress for this hurried debate. It was, in fact, Senator Byrd who led the way in the opposition. And he and Senator Kennedy and others stood up initially and said, we need more time. They reminded their colleagues of the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which had been brought to the Congress during the Vietnam War with the alleged claim that our ships had been attacked in the Gulf of Tonkin, later to have proven to be false. And that Gulf of Tonkin resolution, as we know, escalated the United States' involvement in Vietnam. They said that cloud hangs over this debate. We need more time. We need to vet this evidence that the President is presenting, the claims that he's making, the dangers posed by Iraq. But their colleagues would have nothing of this. They spent 2 days, 2 days and only two, on this question of the October resolution. And Senator Byrd, known for his command of history, linked the debate to a revolution more than two centuries ago. Mr. President, he said, here in this pernicious resolution on which this Senate will vote soon, we find the dagger that is being held at the throat of the Senate of the United States. I say to my friends, we ought to pause and wonder if Captain John Parker and his Minutemen fought on the green of Lexington for this piece of rag, this so-called resolution. When Parker lost 8 or 10 of his men with that first shot, is that what they died for? This resolution? Is that what they died for? How about John Paul Jones when he was fighting the Serapis? He was the captain of the Bonhomme Richard when he said, I have not yet begun to fight. What was he fighting for? Was he fighting for this piece of cowardice here in this resolution, which gives to the President, lock, stock, and barrel, the authority to use the military forces of this country however he will, whenever he will, and wherever he will, and for as long as he will? We are handing this over to the President of the United States, Senator Byrd continued. When we do that, we can put a sign on the top of this Capitol, and we can say, gone home, gone fishing, out of business. Senator Byrd rose a final time during this debate on the night of October 10th, 2002. He quoted Hermann Göring, the founder of the Gestapo, president of the Reichstag, Nazi parliament, and a convicted war criminal. In a 1934 speech, Göring said this, naturally, the common people don't want war. But after all, it is the leaders of a country who determine the policy, and it is always a simple matter to drag the people along. Whether it is a democracy, or a fascist dictatorship, or a parliament, or a communist dictatorship, voice or no voice, the people can always be brought to the bidding of their leaders. That is easy. All you have to do is tell them they are being attacked and denounce the pacifists for a lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same in every country. Now, there was a different theme that some members of Congress stood up to argue. And that was, trust the president. The president has the facts. The president knows the evidence. He tells us there's this threat. Richard Armey, then Majority Leader of the House, asked, should we vote on this resolution that says, in effect, that we, the Congress of the United States, the representation of the people of the United States, say, Mr. President, we trust you and we rely on you in a dangerous time to be our Commander-in-Chief and to use the resources we place at your disposal? The answer, Armey said, is yes. Representative Wally Herger of California said, I firmly believe that our president will make the right decision in the best interest of the United States, and I have the utmost confidence in the integrity of his counsel. Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison of Texas stated, the president has solid information that with a small amount of highly enriched uranium, Iraq could have a nuclear weapon in less than a year. Trust the president. He knows best. Well, of course, the framers never intended to allow one individual, no matter how honest or not he or she may be, to have this kind of power and to have this kind of trust in one individual to make that decision. But yet, the majority of both the House and the Senate voted for this resolution, and there remained one branch of our government that could stand in the way of the president's march to this illegal war, and that was the federal judiciary. And when we filed this case in February of 2003, we held a press conference in the Old South Meeting House in Boston, which was a fitting venue because on December 16, 1773, more than 5,000 colonists had crowded into the Old South Meeting House to debate a controversial tea tax. The meeting sparked the Boston Tea Party, in which colonists celebrated protests against the British monarchy, in which colonists had dumped 342 chests of tea into the Boston Harbor. 230 years later, Charlie Richardson, the father of a United States Marine based in the Persian Gulf, stood before a bank of microphones and television cameras. Richardson was there to explain why he was among the plaintiffs filing suit that day against the president. As the father of a United States Marine, Richardson said, there is only one thing worse than the prospect of receiving a call telling me that my son Joe has been killed in battle. It is the prospect of being told that he has been killed fighting an illegal and unconstitutional war. Nancy Lesson, Richardson's wife and the stepmother of Joe, was there as well. She held a photo of Joe for the cameras. We noticed, she said, that those who say we've got to go to war aren't going anywhere, nor are their loved ones. It is other people's children who are now in harm's way, our children. She said a momentous decision to send the nation into war could not be made by one person. Such a decision had to be made by the United States Congress. As cases go, the first question always comes after you file it, who did you draw? What judge did you get? And it's supposedly a random process, and it often has a lot of an impact on how the case proceeds. Well, we drew Federal Judge Joseph Toro, the Federal District Court in Boston, who's been on the federal bench there for quite some time. In fact, 30 years ago, he heard the case of Drynan v. Nixon. Father Robert Drynan, then member of Congress, brought a lawsuit with four members of the United States Air Force to try and stop the illegal bombing of Cambodia. And at that same time, Elizabeth Holtzman, then member of Congress from New York, brought a similar case in the federal courts in New York with other members of the U.S. Air Force to try to stop the illegal bombing of Cambodia. And Judge Toro heard this case that Father Drynan and others had brought before him, and he had decided back then, 30 years ago, that there needed to be a conflict, a direct conflict, between the Congress and the President in order for a federal judge to intervene on a matter of war and peace, and that if the Congress and the President are not in direct conflict, there was no basis for him to intervene, that it was, in his view, a political question, solely for the two political branches of government. Now, if you agree with his theory, then under that theory, Congress can collude with the President of the United States to undermine the Constitution, and the federal judiciary would have no role. But as far back as 1803, former Chief Justice John Marshall stated in the celebrated case Marbury v. Madison that it is precisely the role of the courts to declare what the law is. And in the instance of war and peace and whether the War Powers Clause has been followed, the question remains, is this matter constitutional that the President's engaged in, regardless of whether Congress is in direct conflict or not? It also presumes, Judge Toro's theory does, that our default position can somehow be that we are at war and Congress must bring us to peace. Well, it's precisely the opposite. The framers never intended that we would, at default, be at war all the time. Our default position is that we're at peace, and the only way we're brought into war is via the Congress bringing us into war. Suffice it to say, Judge Toro was not a good draw. And when we went before him that day in February of 2003, he had no questions for the Justice Department representing the President, Secretary Rumsfeld, and no questions for us. No, he sat there, he asked if the lectern needed to be moved at all, and was quite cordial, but he had no questions. And then at the end of the presentation by both sides as to this issue of whether or not this war was being done in accordance with the Constitution, he announced that he would have his decision in 1 hour and that we were all invited to come back in an hour to hear it. That's always a bad sign if you're on the plaintiff's side. And we came back, and sure enough, Judge Toro read from his three-page double-spaced memorandum of law in which he cited two cases, Drynan v. Nixon and Elizabeth Holtzman's case. And he said there's no conflict here between Congress and the President, and therefore I find that I cannot intervene, and this is a political question. We were determined not to let Judge Toro have the last word on this matter, and so I, after he left the courtroom and others had filed out, I went to the clerk and I said, we need this to be entered so that a notice of appeal can be filed. The proper procedure is you have to have formal judgment entered by the district court before you can file a notice of appeal. And of course it can take months, sometimes years, to get before the federal appeals court in this country, but I was determined to do whatever we could to get the notice of appeal filed right away. So I said to her, I said to the clerk, I said, we need this filed right away. She said, well, how about tomorrow? I said, no, we're filing this afternoon notice of appeal. We need this entered. She said, okay, I got it. So then I came back later that afternoon. We filed the notice of appeal, and we asked for emergency consideration by the Federal Appeals Court to hear this case in light of the fact that hundreds of thousands of troops were on the border of Iraq and this war was imminent. And the next day, to the Federal Appeals Court, credit. They granted argument the following week, and they expedited briefing, and we would have argument the following week before a three-judge panel, the Federal Appeals Court in Boston. And I will say that this time, the judges read the briefs, and this time they had questions for both sides, for the Justice Department, for us. And by the end of the hearing, they hadn't made their minds up, at least they didn't say they had, and they said they would take it under advisement. And a week later, they issued a ruling, 30-some pages, which is available, by the way, via the website Military Family Speak Out, MFSO.org. And it was, I think, at least to a large extent, a thoughtful opinion. They did not agree with our theory that Congress had unlawfully delegated to the President this power to declare war, because they still bought into this view that the Second Circuit Court of Appeals had found, and Judge Toro had reiterated, which is there need to be a direct conflict between the President and Congress. But they did find that our alternative argument might have merit. And our alternative argument was that Congress, when it passed this resolution, conditioned it on the President receiving approval from the United Nations Security Council to invade Iraq. And the reason why we made this alternative argument is in the legislative history of the debate on the floor of the Senate, Senators Joe Biden, John Kerry, and others stated that they had been promised by the President They had been promised that he would do whatever he could to ensure that this would be a multilateral effort, that the United Nations would be involved, and that he, the president, would go back to the United Nations for a second resolution. And they also said they had been promised that if they didn't get that second resolution, if the United Nations did not approve, then the president would have to come back to the American people and explain why we needed to unilaterally invade Iraq without the support of the United Nations and what the consequences would be for the nation. The president, of course, never made that speech, and Senators Biden, Kerry, and others remained silent in the final hours leading up to the war on that alleged promise that the president made, which they had said they would speak out on if he reneged on that promise. But that being the case, the theory before this court was that the condition had not been met. The United Nations Security Council had not yet authorized this war under the United Nations and Charter, and therefore the president didn't have the power to invade Iraq. The Federal Appeals Court came back and said the matter on that issue was not ripe. It was not ripe because the United Nations Security Council had yet to formally reject any resolution that the president had submitted, and it was unclear that if they were to object to this war and not pass such a resolution, that the president would actually proceed, nonetheless, with a unilateral invasion, despite the fact that, again, there were hundreds of thousands of troops already on the border of Iraq. But we waited out the Azores summit weekend. As you may remember, the president and his coalition of the willing, Prime Minister Blair and the president of Spain, gathered in Azores to have their final summit on what they would do, this coalition of the willing, if the United Nations did not approve their resolution. Then they went back that following Monday. They said, we're going to give the United Nations Security Council one last chance. And they went back, and then by 11 a.m. that day, they had withdrawn their resolution. Germany and France were still not going to support this war. And it was announced that the president would be making a nationally televised speech to the nation the following evening on the issue of Iraq. It was pretty clear what was about to happen. The bombs were about to be dropped on Baghdad without United Nations approval. We rushed back into court with a motion for emergency consideration. The facts are here, Your Honors. The facts that you said were not yet available. The case was not yet ripe. It's now ripe. We have a direct conflict. The United Nations has rejected this resolution. It's not going to pass, and the president is going to proceed nonetheless. And this time, the court wasn't as willing to engage in the discussion. It issued a one-paragraph ruling in which it said, these facts are here, but there still need to be other facts in order for the case to be ripe. Now, I still don't know what other facts they were talking about. I invite you to try to match that opinion with their lengthy opinion they initially issued and figure out whether they're consistent. It's Orwellian what they ended up saying. But in the end, this is a story of all three branches of government failing us. The legislative branch passing on to the executive unlawfully this power to start a war against another nation. The executive branch for seizing monarchical powers in taking this nation to war. And the judiciary for standing on the sidelines and not doing its duty to protect and uphold the Constitution. And now we must turn to the Downing Street minutes. This revelation coming May 1st, 2005, the Sunday Times of London, revealing that there was a secret meeting on July 23rd, 2002, months before the president went to the Congress with his resolution, months before they went to the United Nations with requests for inspections, there was this secret meeting. And Richard Dearlove, the senior British intelligence officer at the time, the head of MI6, the equivalent of our Central Intelligence Agency, had come back from Washington, where he had been engaged in meetings with senior U.S. government officials about the Bush administration's plans with respect to Iraq. And he had come back to 10 Downing Street, the Prime Minister's residence, to report on what he had learned. It was an official briefing that he was to give the Prime Minister and other top national security officials in the Blair administration. And I recognize But there's been a lot that's already been reported. Paul O'Neill, former Treasury Secretary, said within days after the president taking office in 2001, he wanted to talk about regime change in Iraq. Bob Woodward, in his book, has talked about the plans for invading Iraq long before the Congress had any deliberations on this. I recognize that there's been others who have come out and made this point. But these Downing Street minutes are official government minutes of a meeting that was never supposed to come to light. And they were leaked by a courageous whistleblower in Britain to the Sunday Times of London. And in this meeting, Richard Dearlove states that the president had decided, President Bush, had decided to overthrow Iraqi President Saddam Hussein by launching a war which he reports would be, quote, justified by the conjunction of terrorism and WMD, weapons of mass destruction. Dearlove continues, but the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy. British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw states that, quote, it seemed clear that Bush had made up his mind to take military action, even if the timing was not yet decided. But, he continues, the case was thin. Saddam was not threatening his neighbors, and his WMD capability was less than that of Libya, North Korea, and Iran. British officials have not disputed the authenticity of these minutes. They've not said this meeting never took place. There's been no evidence that's come forward since the release of these minutes that contradict Mr. Dearlove in any way whatsoever. And on May 6th, Knight Ridder newspapers reported that, quote, a former senior U.S. official called the document, quote, an absolutely accurate description of what transpired during the senior British intelligence officer's visit to Washington. On May 5th, Congressman John Conyers Jr. and 88 other members of Congress sent a letter to the president asking basic questions about the Downing Street minutes. Was it true that you had decided to invade Iraq by July 2002? Was it true that you had planned to justify this invasion by the conjunction of terrorism and WMD, weapons of mass destruction? Was it true that your plan was to fix the intelligence around the policy? Basic questions requiring basic answers. There are now 130-plus members of the U.S. House of Representatives who have signed this letter. And still the president has refused to answer it. Congressman Conyers thought, well, let me take this to the people. Let me ask people around this country, I'm sure many of you in this audience, to sign on to this letter. And if I can get 500,000 people of this nation to join me in asking these basic questions, maybe then the president will see to it to answer it. He got 560,000 signatures, and we assisted him, along with many others. We assisted him with AfterDowningStreet.org, our coalition, to get those signatures. And he delivered those signatures, along with other members of Congress, to the White House, to the gates, was not allowed in, had low-level aides come and receive the stacks of names of all the people around the nation who had signed this letter. And still no response from this president. On May 26, we launched AfterDowningStreet.org, this coalition of veterans groups, peace groups, public interest organizations, ordinary citizens from around this country, calling for a full congressional investigation into whether or not the president has committed impeachable offenses in connection with the Iraq War. The Downing Street minutes, if true, reveal that the president has engaged in a conspiracy to deceive and mislead the United States Congress and the American people about the basis for going to war against Iraq. And such conduct ought to be seen as a high crime under the United States Constitution. Article 2, Section 4 of the United States Constitution, which states, the President, Vice President, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Now, the framers... The framers of the United States Constitution drafted Article 2, Section 4 to ensure that the people of the United States, through their representatives in the United States Congress, could hold a president accountable for an abuse of power and abuse of public trust. James Madison, speaking at Virginia's ratifying convention, stated, "A president is impeachable if he attempts to subvert the Constitution." Alexander Hamilton, writing in The Federalist, stated that impeachment is for, quote, "the misconduct of public men from the abuse or violation of some public trust." James Iredell, who later became a justice of the United States Supreme Court, stated at North Carolina's ratifying convention, "The president must certainly be punishable for giving false information to the Senate. He is to regulate all intercourse with foreign powers, and it is his duty to impart to the Senate every material intelligence he receives." Iredell went on to say that if the president should appear that he has not given the Congress full information, has concealed important intelligence which he ought to have communicated, and by that means induced them to enter into measures injurious to their country, then that ought to be considered an impeachable offense. On July 25th, 1974, then Representative Barbara Jordan spoke to her colleagues on the House Judiciary Committee of the constitutional basis for impeachment. "The powers," she said, "relating to impeachment are an essential check in the hands of this body, the legislature, against and upon the encroachment of the executive. Impeachment," she added, "is chiefly designed for the president and his high ministers to somehow be called into account. It is designed to bridle the executive if he engages in excesses. It is designed as a method of national inquest into the conduct of public men. The framers confined in the Congress the power, if need be, to remove the president in order to strike a delicate balance between a president swollen with power and grown tyrannical, and preservation of the independence of the executive." The question must now be asked, with the release of the Downing Street minutes, whether the president has committed impeachable offenses. Is it a high crime to engage in a conspiracy to deceive and mislead the United States Congress and the American people about the basis for taking the nation into war? Is it a high crime to manipulate intelligence so as to allege falsely a national security threat posed to the United States as a means of trying to justify a war against another nation based on preemptive purposes? Is it a high crime to commit a felony via the submission of an official report to the United States Congress falsifying the reasons for launching military action? I can think of no higher crime that a president of the United States can commit than to send young men and women off into battle, off to their death, based on a potential lie. Dealing with this question of federal criminal law, we have to go to what the president sent to the United States Congress within 48 hours of launching his first strike invasion of Iraq, a document he was required to present, required under the War Powers Act, the statute that in the wake of the Vietnam War had been passed to ensure that there would be at least some reporting requirements a president would make with respect to military action, and required under the October 2002 resolution. The president sent this letter, available on his website, the White House website, whitehouse.gov. It was dated March 18, 2003. Bombs had begun to fall on Baghdad. "Dear Mr. Speaker, Consistent with Section 3B of the Authorization for Use of Military Force Against Iraq Resolution of 2002, Public Law 107-243, and based on information available to me, including that in the enclosed document, I determine that, one, reliance by the United States on further diplomatic and other peaceful means alone will neither A, adequately protect the national security of the United States against the continuing threat posed by Iraq, nor B, likely lead to enforcement of all relevant United Nations Security Council resolutions regarding Iraq. And two, acting pursuant to the Constitution and Public Law 107-243 is consistent with the United States and other countries continuing to take the necessary actions against international terrorists and terrorist organizations, including those nations, organizations, or persons who planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11th, 2001. If the President of the United States knew, when he signed this letter, sent this document, this official document, over to the United States Congress, that he was stating a falsehood, if he knew that there was no national security threat posed by Iraq to the United States, if he knew that there was no link between Saddam Hussein's Iraq and September 11th, then the President has committed a violation of the False Statements Accountability Act of 1996, which makes it a felony to make any false statement to the United States Congress. If he knew that these were false statements, the President has also violated the broad anti-conspiracy statute under federal criminal law, which makes it a felony to defraud the United States or any agency thereof. If all this is true from the Downing Street minutes, then the President has committed a high crime, and the President has committed felonies, and he must be held accountable. Now, we launched this campaign on May 26, less than 2 months. We're getting a million hits to our website every day. This is a coalition that's growing on a daily basis. Tens of thousands of people all over this country have joined this campaign, calling upon Congress to introduce a resolution of inquiry, launching a formal investigation into whether the President's committed impeachable offenses. Yesterday, Congresswoman Barbara Lee made a major first step toward that by introducing a resolution of inquiry that forces documents to be turned over by the President of the United States and by the State Department relating to any conversations that members of the U.S. government had with Mr. Dearlove and anything else that occurred between January 2002 and October 16, 2002, when Congress passed that resolution. That resolution of inquiry that Congresswoman Lee has introduced, which we helped support and draft, is being supported by 25 other members of Congress, including Congressman John Conyers, Jr. We urge you to contact members of Congress and the congressional delegation in this state and other neighboring states and to call upon them to join Congresswoman Lee's resolution. It is an important next step in the demand for this full investigation. You can go to our website, afterdowningstreet.org. You can get access to the resolution. You can get access to those on the International Relations Committee who are the ones that will be first hearing this resolution. We need to urge people all over this country. Call your neighbors, call your friends, call people you know all over this country to get behind this resolution of inquiry. It's critical that we as a nation, we as a people, get to the truth and get to the bottom of what happened in the lead up to this war and whether this war was started based on a potential lie. We held a hearing, as many of you may know, with Congressman John Conyers. He organized and hosted the hearing that we helped support on June 16, 2005, in the basement of the Capitol in a tiny room that is reserved for Nancy Pelosi, reserved for the minority leader of the House. She usually holds some meetings there, private meetings and so forth. And no member of the Republican leadership was willing to grant any other space in all the buildings for the U.S. Congress. So we held it in a tiny room that was bigger than really from these two rows of pews, all of us really fitting in there. 30 members of Congress showed up for this hearing, many of whom were standing because there were no seats for most people there. Members of the media were there, and then the four of us testifying. I was honored to be with Ambassador Joe Wilson, with Ray McGovern, 27-year veteran of the Central Intelligence Agency, and with Cindy Sheehan, co-founder of Gold Star Families for Peace, the mother of a Marine son who was killed during this war. And we had this conversation for 3+ hours about the Downing Street minutes and their constitutional implications. And then we went over to the White House, where Congressman Conyers and other members of Congress delivered their letter and the signatures from over 500,000 people. Tomorrow marks the third anniversary of this secret meeting that occurred at 10 Downing Street. And all over this country, there will be 400+ house parties, citizens coming together to talk about the Downing Street minutes, to raise public consciousness, to support Congresswoman Lee's resolution of inquiry, to support the demand for a full investigation of whether or not the President committed impeachable offenses, all organized at the grassroots level through this campaign. 8 members of Congress will be joining by holding town hall meetings in their home districts. Congressman Conyers will hold one in Detroit. Congresswoman Maxine Waters will hold one in Los Angeles. Congresswoman Barbara Lee in the Bay Area. Congressman Hinchey and former Congresswoman Elizabeth Holtzman will hold one in New York City. This is going to be an historic day. We are going to stand up. We are going to demand the truth from this administration, whether it engaged in lies, sending this nation into war. I just want to spend just a few moments, because I know I've gone on here, and I want to very much hear your questions and comments. I want to just spend a few moments about the link that all of this has to Patrick Fitzgerald's investigation of who outed a CIA covert operative. Who outed a CIA covert operative? Valerie Plame Wilson. And to set the context for this, we must go back to what was happening at the time that Ambassador Wilson submitted his op-ed to the New York Times in July 2003. We had invaded Iraq, March 2003, on the alleged threat the nation posed to Iraq, to the United States. And we were now on the hunt for those weapons of mass destruction that were supposed to be all over Iraq. And on Sunday, May 11th, 2003, the Washington Post ran a headline on its front page, "Frustrated U.S. Arms Team to Leave Iraq, Task Force Unable to Find Any Weapons." The newspaper reported that the 75th Exploitation Task Force of the United States Army, quote, "the group directing all known U.S. search efforts for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq," was, quote, "winding down operations without finding proof that Saddam Hussein kept clandestine stocks of outlawed arms." The article quoted Army Colonel Richard McPhee, a leader of the task force, as saying, "My unit has not found chemical weapons. That's a fact. And I'm 47 years old, having a birthday in one of Saddam Hussein's palaces on a lake in the middle of Baghdad. It's surreal. The whole thing is surreal." Referring to the weapons of mass destruction, McPhee said, "Do I know where they are? I wish I did. But we will find them, or not. I don't know. I'm being honest here." 2 weeks prior to the Washington Post article, the British newspaper, The Independent, reported that, quote, "intelligence agencies on both sides of the Atlantic were furious that briefings they gave political leaders were distorted in the rush to war with Iraq." The newspaper quoted a high-level UK source who said they ignored intelligence assessments which said Iraq was not a threat. And then comes Ambassador Wilson's op-ed, July 6, 2003, to the New York Times, in which he reveals that he was sent on a mission by the Central Intelligence Agency to Niger to determine whether or not this claim that Niger had tried to sell uranium, yellowcake, to Saddam Hussein regime, to determine whether or not that claim was true. And he reveals in this op-ed that he went on that mission, that he asked all of his contacts that he had in that region, and that he had come back to report that these claims were highly doubtful, that there was no evidence that he could find that there was this purported sale of uranium to Iraq. And he said in this op-ed that the president and his administration had twisted the intelligence with respect to this critical question. And we have to remember that in this selling of the war, Condoleezza Rice, the president himself, they got up there on national television, speeches around the country, and they talked about the danger of a mushroom cloud coming over the United States because of Saddam Hussein's potential threat of nuclear weapons. This was a critical component in the selling of their war. And here was Ambassador Wilson coming forward to say it was a hoax, to unmask it all, to unveil the cover-up. And the White House reacted sharply and strongly. They were going to go after Ambassador Wilson. They were going to do whatever they could to try to discredit him, because they could not allow this cover-up to be unveiled. They could not allow the truth to be revealed. And so they went so far as to go after his wife, a covert CIA operative. And now we have this investigation that Patrick Fitzgerald is engaged in. And as a scandal it is, to identify a covert CIA operative to the media, to break classified information, to endanger her and her sources and the intelligence community as a whole, as a scandal as that is, the larger scandal is the 1,700-plus United States soldiers who are now dead, the tens of thousands of Iraqi civilians who are now dead, the thousands on both sides who are permanently injured because of this war, this reckless war. That is the larger scandal. And we are exploring, calling upon Patrick Fitzgerald's special counsel to expand his investigation beyond the CIA leak to the larger question of why was Valerie Plame Wilson targeted? Why was Ambassador Wilson targeted? What was their motive? Ken Starr started out his investigation on Whitewater, real estate deal in Arkansas, McClinton's involvement in Whitewater. He traveled from Whitewater to Monica Lewinsky. Whitewater to Monica Lewinsky. This is not that far to travel. The outing of Valerie Plame Wilson to whether or not the president engaged in a deliberate deception campaign about this war are linked directly together. And so we think it's important that this investigation proceed beyond this question of who outed the CIA covert operative to the larger question of whether the president and whether other members of his administration have engaged in this deception campaign to sell us an illegal and unconstitutional war. I urge people to go to our website after downingstreet.org to join us, to join Congressman John Conyers, Jr., and others, to stand up for our democracy. It is time to hold up the Constitution of those who dare to defy it. It is time to demand our country back. Thank you very much.
To hear more programs like this, go to the Action section of iraqproject.org. That's www.iraqproject.org. This is WBCR LP 97.7 FM Great Barrington, Massachusetts. This is Mickey Friedman, and this is The Other Side.